So this won't be a guided meditation per se. I'm not going to tell you what to do, but I'm going to check in with you a few times and ask you to make a note of some things. So you can use whatever meditation object you like, anapana, whatever, your standard meditation. And again, a few times I'll check in on you, and then at the end I'll ring the bell, and then that will not be the end. There's going to be a few things to say at the very end. Where are you right now? Are you with the object that you're supposed to be with? If not, where have you gone? You indulging in some fantasy about the past, the future? Is it some thoughts of ill will or anxiety? Is the mind restless, bouncing around? Are you just kind of dull and drowsy, gone off to sleep? Or maybe you're just not certain what you're doing. Make a note of where you maybe have gone and get back to your primary object. Hello. Where are you right now? Are you with the breath or whatever your object of meditation? If not, where did you go? Try to break it down into maybe five main categories. There's sensual fantasies or sensuality, desires, ill will, aversion. The sloth and torpor of just sliding off into nowhere, not knowing where you are. Restlessness, agitation, remorse. The mind is bouncing around. And there's uncertainty. Maybe I should be doing this, maybe I should be doing that. Make a note of where you've been. Get back to the primary object of meditation. Hello. Where are you? Are you with your primary object? Maybe your mind's off in some kind of sensual thoughts, things you would like to do, want to do. Maybe you're thinking thoughts of ill will or aversion. Maybe your mind's just gone kind of blank and dull. Maybe it's bouncing all over the place. Or maybe you're just not certain what you should be doing. These are five categories of things that could be going wrong. Make a mental note of what maybe has happened. Get back to your primary object of meditation. stop your primary object and just spend a few minutes till I ring the bell again, just reviewing how the sit went. Were you able to stay? If you didn't stay with the object of meditation, where did you go? Was there common themes in your distractions? Just make a note of how it went. There's not judging involved. It's not your mind to judge. It's just the mind doing what the mind does. Just assess how that seemed to be. Was it any periods of time you could stay with your object, or was it constant battle of the waves, pushing the little ship of the mind all over the place wherever you wanted to go? Or was it some calm and clarity at points, and then maybe some turbulence? Just kind of reflect on it for a couple minutes.
Ramaka lokati pati saham pati katanjali anadewaram ayatata santita satapara shaka shakika desetu tamam anukam pimam pajam.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So I had been asked to talk about basics. Basics of meditation. And this will be partially about that, but it's just basic. I think one of the things that's important to recognize, and I won't spend the majority of the time on it, but that it's not really just the cushion. The training, the cessation of suffering, which is the goal, is it's like a way of life. Even if we live in the world, we incline to live in a way that reduces our suffering and accords with a more wholesome and skillful way of living. So the picture is a little bit bigger. One of the things that I found quite interesting getting into the Pali chanting over the years is the common use of the term viharati, which means to dwell. And the Buddha used this term's all over the place. The Buddha was staying at Savatthi in Anathapindika's park. He'll be using viharati, dwell. The monastery is called a vihara often in different countries. It's the Pali word for dwelling. But it's also the same word that's used for jhanas, or dwelling in the Brahma-viharas, or even unskillful mental states, one dwells in those states. And I think by considering like what's the basics, like the premise of like what is the basics of meditation, even kind of betrays a little bit of preconceived notion about what it's about. And I want to kind of point to the fact that when we think that the practice is some like, I'm going to sit down and do this technique, and that's going to give rise to a certain state of being, we've already set up essentially a false premise and a misdirecting that's going to cause us problems. Anapana, I find, would actually be fundamentally an anchor for lots of other observations and learning about the mind. And when I first started, in an effort to try to get my mind to recognize that it was a continual process, not just meditation, because I had an alarm clock. It was this nice little bell that would chime. It was not an electric, a real physical bell that it struck on the hour. And wherever I was, I would, just like I was doing in this little bit of example of how to do a practice of fundamentally the hindrances. This is what I was pointing out with the five different places the mind can go. The bell would ring and I'd be like, you know, think I would stop for a second whatever I was doing, as long as it was, you know, safe, I'm sure. You know, I wasn't doing anything like hammering a nail or something. But where is my mind? Am I indulging? Am I angry? Am I present with what I'm doing? Is that, you know, if I'm not, let's say, sitting and meditating, though, if I'm cooking, am I just present with cooking? Am I cleaning? Am I just present with cleaning? Am I dwelling where I'm supposed to be dwelling? Or is my mind wandering off? Is it engaged in some kind of hindering, suffering state of existence? So I'm going to step back from that concept but return to it, but the total picture is what we call the threefold training, which is sila, samadhi, and panya. And I'm going to spend a brief bit on this before we go back to the dwelling in the mind. But the mind is just, in meditation, is just one part of the picture. It's often called like a tripod of support. One has to have a proper moral structure to life. One has to apply the mind to stillness. And then one has to develop and cultivate insight and wisdom. And if any one of these three things is weak, ultimately you're not really going to make progress. You have to work on them equally and evenly. So to say them in brief, just to make sure that everybody understands the kind of fundamental of morality in the Buddhist tradition is the five precepts for lay people. Not taking life, not taking what is given, no sexual misconduct, refraining from false and harmful speech, and refraining from intoxicants. This isn't any kind of edict from the Buddha high up in some cloud saying you have to do this for his sake. This is just an aspect of training the mind and having your life be wholesome, is picking up these wholesome, simple ways of living that do not cause the hindrances to be stirred up, agitated, supported, and continue. If one take something or says something that one might regret, you know, restless and remorse. Oh, I can't believe I did that. Somebody's going to find out about that. Intoxicants, sensual indulgence tend to go right hand in hand. You know, intoxicants in and of themselves don't have a negative comma. They often just lead to the unwholesome commas. But these five precepts are fundamental to the training in elimination of suffering. The second, samadhi. This is calmness, stillness, focus of mind. I hate really the word concentration. It's kind of, in the Buddha often uses several terms in front of samadhi, stilled, calm, tranquil. It doesn't have to be a point. It's more like the knowing quality of mind is just unperturbed by the impingements of the world and stays wherever it's supposed to be. It's unhindered by the five hindrances. And for most people, for many years, hindrances, they can just keep going on and on and on and on. That's one of the reasons why I felt I'd make an important part of this conversation, is that that's really what needs to be overcome and needs to be understood. This is the root of a lot of the suffering. This is the root of a lot of the difficulties in the meditative practice, is the idea that I'm going to sit down and do some technique and there's going to be some miracle by means of the technique. But the actual awareness of, let's say, the breath is really just a place to say, I'm going to apply myself and then see what happens. And if we don't take a proactive position in trying to understand what happens and figure out why it's happening, then we're not going to, we're just going to keep, well, I just can't get concentrated. Why can't I not stay with the breath? Why can't I get full body awareness? Why can't I do this? Why can't I do that? Doesn't the objects of meditation have their value? But fundamentally, it's all about suffering and the cessation of suffering. And the hindrances are the majority of what suffering is for most people. And these are dwellings. People dwell and roll in their hindrances and create karma to keep their hindrances going. So when we spend our time in our meditation, let's say, anchored to the breath, but some thought keeps coming back, it's a place to reflect on, what am I doing in my life that's causing this thing to occur? And it's karma, usually. It's usually like, I've been entertaining this thought a lot, or I haven't rectified this situation, or I shouldn't have done that act, or I should have watched what I said. The myriad of things it can be is countless and infinite. And that is the practice that each individual person has to sort out, is what am I doing to cause this to happen? And how can I stop doing that? Precepts are an anchor. But the panya side, the third part, is that these five hindrances have a subtler basis, usually in the three, can be categorized in impermanence, issues of impermanence or permanence, suffering, often around thoughts of the past or the future, and then the ideas of self, propping up a self, promoting a sense of self, which is often around ideation, views and opinions. So this, by looking at these hindrances and using the three marks of the Dhamma, the three key fundamental combining things of suffering, we can get to the root of where these hindrances are coming from. And by getting to the roots of the hindrances, we then start to unravel them. They start to lose their strength. Now for the hindrances, these hindrances in particular, I'll talk a little bit more about them. They're not, there's no like hard, fast line. You can, sometimes hindrances can be mixes of the two. Like most dhammas, they're just, you know, I like the word pattern as one of the translations for dhamma. It's like a pattern of the mind. But it isn't an objectification. Like, not everything is going to fit in one or the other. And often they can, you know, could be judged in either one. They're just generally frameworks that one can, like, reflect on. Like, what is this state of mind? Is it one of these things? And where might that be coming from? So the first one, classically, sensory indulgence. There's a simile that the Buddha gives for this. There are five similes for these. They're all around water. It makes it easier to remember. So the simile of water for sensual indulgence is, it's water that's colored brightly with dyes. So it's like living with rose-colored glasses. Like, oh, that cake, oh, I bet you that's going to taste good. Oh, man. Oh, well, it's not as good as I thought it was. Boy, I'm disappointed. These kind of way, our mind bouncing around these things that we think are going to make us happy and they don't make us happy. We think they're going to last, but they don't last. We get some of it, we want more of it. It's not seeing clearly, it's seeing things tainted with bright colors that make it seem like it's more than it really is. Kind of on the flip side of the sensory indulgence, this is kind of a craving, a wanting, a liking, is ill will. Simile for this is boiling water. We connect with our bodily awareness, and often can be, you know, the heat or agitation associated with ill will or anger or aversion. Can't talk about this one too much because I've been lived a fairly like ill will free life. So, I don't know. I guess I'm kind of lucky. Everybody carries their own baggage, but this is one I have a hard time connecting with. I've never really had any, you know, if I have a problem with somebody, I don't generally make it personal. It's like, okay, well, this person has a problem. There is one. There have been a few people, and there's a practice. I'll bring up a specific practice regarding ill will, and it's around the idea of, there's a term called nimittas, which are signs and characteristics. And one of the things about, like, say, in particular people or situations, that there'll be certain signs and characteristics that'll often trigger you before the actual interaction with the person. Just knowing that they're present will often might agitate you, or a certain situation, like, oh, you gotta speak or something like that. So there's certain characteristics. Is being very proactive in trying to recognize those signs and characteristics, and in a meditation or prior to being exposed to them, cultivate positive mind states around that situation. Like, you know, if you have to do something that you're not looking forward to, you know, recognize that there are any potential positive things that may be associated with it, and really try to actively lift, like, say, positive qualities of an individual or positive aspects of an experience, and don't dwell on the negative side or the aversive side. And so when you're seeing these first signs of being involved in a situation with a person or some kind of task that you don't want to do, you've already kind of pre-primed your conditioned response to consider a more expansive view of the situation. And then that gives you an opportunity to lift that up, as opposed to dwelling in or attaching to the negativity. The third hindrance, sloth and torpor. The simile for this one is like water that's full of plants and algae and muck. And it's probably one of the most difficult ones. Because it can be so blinding, you don't even know you're like, you know, some of the other ones are actually highly engaging, but they're distracting, they're keeping you away from where you want to be. But this is actually, in some ways, it's a form of nihilism, a form of kind of like trying to get rid of everything and like trying to avoid it, an aversive state. The mind actually, there's a way that it can kind of just shut down, so it can kind of just go into like mud. A murk, and like, you know, an hour will pass and you'll be like, where was I? I don't even remember. I don't even know what I was doing. One of my early Goenka, you know, you think you can figure these things out, and there are certain times you just, you know, like try exercise, like do some working if you're like, if it's a protracted thing. Another suggestion often is diving to more subtlety. Let's say if you're with the breath, like try to find like be more proactive in finding something subtler or something more, you know, engaging in something more interest. That's one of the reasons why I heavily promote the idea of full body awareness, because it's a much more proactive movement through the body as opposed to just trying to stay at one point. There's multiple reasons why it's effective, I think. And one of them is that it's just more engaging. It's more, has more for the mind to do, more for the mind to sort out. Like, oh, okay, well, I've been through this body and I'm not really feeling much in my left leg. Well, let's go spend some time in the left leg. And it causes you to evaluate more. And the actual, the mind wants to evaluate it, wants to do things. And I'm going to kind of close the hindrances with a common thing that many people don't talk about, but it's kind of can be a common to all five hindrances. But let's stay with the five for now. So that's sloth and torpor. The fourth one is restlessness and remorse. And that can be just a kind of agitation. It's not like I want anything or I don't want anything. It's just as opposed to opposite of sloth and torpor, where you kind of just get stuck in the mud. It's the mind that just flittery around with this, with that, just doesn't want to be here, wants to be there, wants to be, you know, anywhere but wherever it's supposed to be. And it's, you know, it's tied often with remorse, but I don't think that that's necessary. I think just restlessness for me, I think, is a better way of categorizing it, because remorse can get into more also like ill will and other, remorse can actually manifest in many different ways. But restlessness is more of a quality of mind that can have any object, but can, is still just the idea that the mind is just agitated and not wanting to stay still. The water simile for this one is water that's like whipped up by the wind, churned up, swirling. It's not staying still. Can't see anything clear in it because it's just surface is all choppy. The last one is doubt. This one can also be, I think, considered next to sloth and torpor for myself, and I think for other people too, is it can be quite a serious problem, because doubt often gets into, well, how do I get out of doubt? Like, the doubt is usually around, it's, you know, like it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, is when one has doubt, one doesn't know what to do about the doubt. But Longpo Pasana summarized it quite well, in that the only way of really getting beyond doubt is to recognize and be comfortable with doubt. Doubt is actually a fundamental nature of kama. Like, even the things that we are doing, they're still wholesome kamas in the practice. And we don't really know if they're going to be efficacious per se. The only time the doubt is actually gone is when one is fully liberated. All along the way, there's still like some areas of uncertainty as to, well, okay, well, maybe I should be doing this, maybe I should be doing that. Well, doubt is not a hindrance if you like recognize, okay, well, it could be this, it could be that. I'm going to do one or the other. I'm going to try something and I'm going to evaluate it. And if it's working, I'm going to keep doing it. If it's not working, I'm going to try something else. That is not a paralyzing doubt. That's not a hindrance. That's just how it is. So one has to recognize that doubt is, because like wholesome kamas, kama is any action rooted in ignorance. So all the wholesome kamas, all of the training, has for the individual, in terms of how one is applying it and the intention that one is putting forth, there is uncertainty there. That's just the way it is. But the question is whether or not you're going to be allowed to be a hindrance or not. And it shouldn't be. You should just keep applying and reviewing, and, you know, if over time things are getting worse and worse and worse, then you might want to consult with a Kalyanamitta, a spiritual friend, advisor, somebody else who, you know, maybe can talk to you and give you some external suggestions. But to be paralyzed and not move because of doubt, well, you're definitely not going anywhere with that. So I wanted to bring these up and tie it back in also to this idea of dwelling, because these are called the hindrances. They're often talked about in terms of hindrances to jhana. And there's this idea that these are only hindrances in the meditation cushion. But I'm not actually a believer that jhana is like a meditative state purely on the cushion. It's a dwelling. Most people in the world who are living their day-to-day lives are dwelling in hindrances. Their mind is hindered by some category of mind state in these five categories. And then there are states of mind that are free from these categories, in which the mind's peaceful. They're still thinking and pondering about the Dhamma, about what I should be doing in terms of a task. But one isn't hindered by it, and one's happy and a pleasant abiding. And one is dwelling day in and day out in that state of mind. So it's not really a state that's exclusively absorbed in on a cushion. It's a state of being, free of defiled, hindering states of mind that plague you and lead you to suffering. So I think that's enough.
And Amayam Amakataya Sadhu Karam Dada Masse Sadhu 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 Anumodami.